Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. You are going to love her. This is Jane Lee Rankin, and she's an author. She's a mother. She's an alpaca farmer. And she's also written a cookbook and went to culinary school. So I think you're really going to love her story. I already do. And welcome, Jane Lee Rankin.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's an honor to have you. So, all right. So I know it all began in Louisville, Kentucky, right? That's where you were born and raised, correct?
That is where I was born and raised. Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah, Louisville. So did you have brothers and sisters? Were you an
older brother? I grew up with three older brothers. I was the youngest. I was the only girl and the youngest. So needless to say, I was spoiled and picked on. How about that?
Okay. Yeah. What was the age difference between you and them?
One brother was a year older, and then it was 3 years and 5 years. So pretty close together.
So did you have any allies?
The ally in our family was Annie, this woman who worked for the family, who came to work for the family when I was 6 weeks old. So at 6 weeks old, my mother and all of the kids got chicken pox. My father was the only one that didn't get sick. And Annie was working for my godmother down the road. And my mother borrowed her to get through chicken pox and stole her.
And never gave her back.
Well, sort of. It was not quite that way. But according to my godmother, she stole her. So I think my mother kept offering her more money or something. I don't know.
Wow.
I didn't realize that till I wrote the cookbook about Annie and ran into my godmother at a book signing. And she said, you know, your mother stole her from me.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Where was Annie? Was she also from Louisville? How do you say it? Louisville?
She was originally from Chambers County, Alabama, and okay. She moved to Louisville years before she started working for us. And that's how we came upon her. So, and she was wonderful. She was such a sweet lady, such a sweet lady, spiritual, religious. She was an incredible cook. And she just was, and because I was the only girl, I just followed her around. I was like her little puppy dog. I followed her around everywhere, and she really took care of me in the midst of all the boys. So
did she sleep over, or did she have her own family?
No, not on a regular basis. I mean, she would occasionally, but not, she stayed at her house. She had children of her own who were older than we were. But she had her own family. So she just came, she was there from like 8:30 to 3:00. She was only there during the day, but she still left a huge imprint on our lives.
And I know, all right. So anything more about your childhood and growing up, and go ahead.
So my mom was an alcoholic, which was sort of a key piece of the story, a wonderful woman, but also struggled with alcoholism. And Annie was the backbone that shepherded us through that in so many ways.
Was your mother like drinking during the day, like just a night drinker? I mean,
yeah, she was just a big drinker. And at the end she was. And then at the end, she went to treatment and she got well and she was amazing. So she actually made it to the other side of alcoholism, which is very unusual. So Yeah. And but at the time, so I grew up, I was born in the 60s, 1960. So
Okay.
at the time, my mother was dealing with alcoholism and we were dealing with it as a family. The Betty Ford Center wasn't even open yet, which puts it in perspective.
So you didn't talk about it.
We didn't talk about it. It was way before women were ever considered able to be alcoholics, even though they were. That if that makes sense, right? It
Yeah.
was a very different time. And people didn't know about it. Like the doctor, she would go to the doctor and the doctor would say, "Well, you can have a glass of wine every once in a while, or here's some Valium," or I mean, they just didn't, there was so little information about alcoholism at that time in our history.
So was it before AA, you think?
No, AA was happening, but it was really a men's club.
I never knew that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was in the beginning. I don't think I've
Really?
ever studied it
Oh,
to know for sure.
yeah.
I'm pretty
Right.
sure it was men in the beginning.
Interesting. Okay.
Back in that at that time, I mean, it was just a it was we were newly into the understanding of what recovery was. Although there were places that you could go to recover, it just was very rare.
Wow. So it just was the way it was. So,
Yeah.
okay. And there was Annie. All right. So you got through high school, I'm assuming. And did
I
you
went
go
through high
to college?
school. I
And if
went
you
to college. I didn't stay very long, came home right away, and then
Okay.
went to college as an adult, went to culinary school as an adult, like in my 30s.
Oh, okay. All right. So what did you do? I know you were telling me you were in real estate and you
I
wrote the
did
cookbook, but that was later,
yeah, I
right?
did a number of different things. When I quit college, I came home and I ended up working in for my father in the family business, which was a stock brokerage business. And I, it was one of those deals, we're missing a new accounts clerk and you can fill in until we find somebody. So that's what I did. And then they didn't find anybody, and then somebody else quit. And I ended up being the number two in the operations department for a little while until we could hire some more people. And I stayed actually longer than my father did. So, yeah, interesting, right? Then he ended up retiring. So I stayed in the business for probably 2.5 years. It wasn't very long, but it was long enough. And I learned a lot doing that job because it was a small brokerage business. We had a seat on the stock exchange. We were putting orders into the New York Stock Exchange. And I got to see life in the stock brokerage business, which is the stock market is the heartbeat, right? So if the market's up, it's good. If the market's down, it's not good. And all matters in between, like, if there's a really big dip in the stock market, there were margin calls and the brokers were really upset and the customers were really upset. And so
So it was
learned
fun.
a lot. I learned a lot doing that
Yeah. And that was from Louisville.
in Louisville. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not saying it right. I'll get it by the end of the show. Okay.
Correct.
Louisville. Okay. Anyway. All right. So you did that. You were getting older.
Yeah,
And.
I worked in a not for a nonprofit for a while. I owned real estate. I mean, I did a number of different things throughout that time. I went to culinary school. I worked in a restaurant. That kind of, I mean, I just a myriad of things that I did. And then I wrote a cookbook.
Right. Now, what made you go to culinary school? Because you wanted to write the cookbook, or did you love to cook? You still
No,
love to cook?
I was working in a restaurant for a little bit and decided that I wanted to go to culinary school, and I was living in the Catskills at the time. Culinary Institute of America was just up there in the Hudson
Yeah,
Valley.
CIA. Yeah.
I went with some friends, with a group of us from the restaurant, went and toured, and I fell in love and was like, you know what? This would be a really cool way to finish my education. So that's what I did. I did that for It's an 18-month program, amazing program, just amazing.
And what did
And
you
I
think?
didn't particularly want to open a restaurant, although I'd thought about it. I didn't, and I loved being in the kitchen, but I wasn't sure that restaurant life was what I wanted. And I had the idea to write the cookbook as soon as I came out. And I went back. They were Annie's recipes. I went back to Louisville to get the recipes because they were in Annie's head. Like she had them all stored in her brain. And so we cooked to get the recipes. And there's no way I could have made it through the cookbook without the education that I had, because it isn't just writing down recipes. You've got to know how to cook and, you know, to navigate all that. So I would, we would, I would come show up at her house with ingredients to cook whatever it is we were working on. And we would cook them, cook whatever it was. And I would stop her and measure with a scale. So if she was putting Crisco in the pie crust or butter, you know, I would weigh the pie crust, the ingredients beforehand, and then I would weigh it afterwards to find out what the amounts were.
Oh my God.
So that I didn't stop her process.
Yeah.
Kept a tape recorder running through the whole thing to get her amazing quotes, because she had some really fun quotes about life and spirit and spirituality and things like that. And that's how we created the cookbook, was we cooked everything. And we started, she was an early riser. So we started early in the morning. And about 10:30 or 11, she was in her early 80s and her health was not great. She had COPD. So we would, by about 10:30 or 11, we'd be cleaning up the kitchen. And her friends very quickly learned that if they showed up between 10:30 and 11, there was food to be had. And so we would package up all this food and send it home with people, because we would make three pies or a cake or whatever. So we'd have all this food that we had made. It was loads of fun.
Wow. And then, so you did that. And how did you, I know you said you self-published, but that was, so when was that? That was, wasn't that before?
That was publishing was
when? 1998. Okay.
So yeah.
Before Amazon, really.
Yeah. Well, it was in the beginning. It was in the beginning of Amazon. I mean, we sold the book on Amazon. But it was in the beginning, and it was at that point in publishing, print on demand was just beginning. Mm. I remember going to one of the book expos and seeing they had brought a print on demand printer for us to see. So that was very new at that point in 98.
I mean, that was like before people were doing it. Wow, that's amazing that you just figured it out and published a book, right?
I took a class online on self-publishing. That's how I did it.
Because back then we weren't really online yet that much, were we?
Not that much. No. No.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. You're very resourceful. Well,
I think I got my first email address in 1996. So that gives you reference to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Wow.
I know.
I mean,
right
now it's so easy, you know,
that we didn't have an email address at one point in our lives.
Right.
Or two or three.
I'm amazed that you, because we were on this, we had this online business that was launching, and it was $9,199. And, you know, nobody's computers could get on, you know, so you're even before then online taking courses and publishing a book. That's incredible.
Yeah. So
that's my
I can remember when, so I actually had the books physically printed, because that was what you did back in the day. And the first edition was hardcover. And I remember, so I was living in an apartment in Louisville and I was upstairs and somebody said, well, where are you going to store them? And I was like, well, I'll just put them in the living room. I mean, I was like, that's not a big deal. And they were like, Lee, do you know how many books 5,000 books is?
You bought 5,000?
I bought 5,000 books. And then, so I ended up not storing them there. I ended up getting a storage place, a warehouse. And then we sold those. We switched and went to paperback. For the second edition. And at that point, Annie had died. So we did second edition in paperback. So within
How did you sell 5,000 books? You just brought them around with you?
So I took them around with me. I got a lot of really good media. It was a great story. So we got lots of good media. I did a book tour with local bookstores and I would ask them for their media list. So Holly Cook was the one in Louisville. I asked for their media list. I reached out to the media. And then I did this. I replicated the same thing through, you know, a group of bookstores and was on radio, TV, and in the paper almost everywhere I went. But that was back when media was that way, right? It was a little bit different. And the deal was if you scheduled a book signing, you had something imminent for them to talk about, right? So it was like, it was a going concern. And then they would put you in the paper or on TV and whatever. And then, so this was a funny story. So one of the first ones that I did was Louisville. And then we went to Lexington. I went to Lexington, Kentucky. And I did one. I was going to be on TV there. And so I was going to do this demonstration on TV. And I was like, oh, I've got to get like bowls. And so I went to the local Williams-Sonoma. And I'm sitting there at the counter, you know, the Williams-Sonoma counter where they've got all the stuff out. And I have a tray and I have all these ramekins and I'm going, okay, pecans. And I'm like talking through the recipe, what I'm going to cook on TV so that I have enough of everything that I need. And I got an apron that would look nice on TV. And the woman said, what are you doing? And I told her, and they ended up picking up the book. So I was in Williams-Sonoma store. So then I added Williams-Sonoma and I would do a cooking demonstration, a book signing, you know. Anyway, it was totally organic. I mean, I did not know what I was doing and it was just perseverance, I guess. I don't know. I just kept.
Was it fun? Did you like it?
I had a blast. I had a blast.
Oh, yeah. Oh, cool. All right. That's so cool. I love that. Because when I wrote a book, my first book, it took me 7 years to get it, like to rewrite it. You know, but it wasn't a cookbook.
Oh, I understand. Yes.
It was a memoir. And then like, I didn't know. It was so hard. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine doing it, you know, 20 years ago or whatever. Wow. So good for you. Let's give you a hand.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. And then what happens?
So I was actually in the process of writing the book. I was close to deadline on the book. And I found out that I had breast cancer on the cookbook. So I sort of stopped everything. We were actually close to getting ready to go to print. So we stopped everything. I went through surgery and some treatment stuff. And then a year later, the book actually got published. It took a little bit longer. It would have been out in 97, but it came out in 98. And I actually moved back to Louisville to actually launch that book. I went back to Louisville, spent more time with Annie, sort of regrouped what was happening with the book because it was, okay. You know, you get a designer that's working and then they move on to another project.
Yeah.
And so some of that stuff. So we relaunched or we refinished it all up in Louisville and launched it in Louisville. And while I was there, I met somebody that I knew from my childhood. And fell in love and we were dating. Well, fell in love, wait, when we were dating. And ended up, I found out I was pregnant on Thanksgiving of the year that the book came out. Big surprise, I was 37 and I was a recent breast cancer survivor. So that was sort of the beginning of this next memoir, which is I'm, you know, in Louisville and I figure out that I'm with Annie actually cooking for each of our family's Thanksgiving dinners. And then I go home and I find out that I go to my apartment and figure out I'm pregnant and then have dinner with my family for Thanksgiving, you know,
Oh my God.
Family and spend the whole Thanksgiving dinner going, well, they'll be okay about it. They won't, they'll be okay about it. They won't. And so that's sort of where the book starts is there. And
the second book. You mean the second book.
Yeah, that second book. As I'm selling the cookbook. I'm still out on tour selling the book. And I leave that night, that Thanksgiving evening, to drive to North Carolina for a book signing in Blowing Rock, which is the area that I end up settling in about 2 years later. So it's an interesting.
Yeah. Now, when you said you went back to Louisville for the book launch, where were you when you went back?
I was in the Catskills still.
Oh, for the
where I'd been to culinary school.
Okay.
Yeah. I had a place up there. I'd been working for, I had a job up there and was working.
Okay. So you find out you were already in the breast cancer. You find out you're pregnant. Did you tell your family that weekend or you did not?
No. Not tell anybody that weekend. No, because it was soon and it was early enough that it was very potentially a false positive. So it was not a done deal. And then, you know, and then I went back to my gynecologist, you know, the whole thing that you do, you go to the gynecologist and the gynecologist says, well, so then I had a follow-up visit with my surgeon in New York who had done the surgery on my breast cancer, went back and followed up with him. Meanwhile, at that point, I had told my boyfriend, and he was not so accepting and willing. And but still, it was still early on, right? So we didn't know how it was all going to work out at that point. But I went to the surgeon, and the surgeon said, "You need to abort. Period. End of story." And I was 37. I wanted to have children. I was equally terrified and elated when I found out I was pregnant. Mm. It's this mixed emotion. I think probably a little bit more elated because I'd always wanted to have children.
Yeah. And were you still in love with the guy? Were you still in love with the guy at this point?
We were still dating, and I had very much, you know, as much as I was like, you know, breaks on, heart was in. I've never figured that out, right? I don't know how to work the car that way. Like,
right.
The reality is the brakes are on, but you know,
yeah.
My heart doesn't listen to that. So
were you crushed when he said he wasn't?
You know, because it took a while. I mean, I was so busy focused on, you know, if I'm gonna do this alone, I didn't have time, right? I just had to sort of run with it. I mean, big life change. I mean, you have children, you know, it's a huge life change.
Right. But I didn't know, you know, I'm just, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, no, I mean, I was terrified, but it was mostly just getting the baby out. I wasn't really looking past that. Like, right. How's it going to fit out? That was my main concern. Right.
Well, there isn't a lot of focus on anything other than getting the baby out when you're pregnant. Right. Well, there is, but there's not.
Besides like the clothes and the nursery, but I didn't care about
one day, and then you've got a whole lifetime to raise.
Right. It's like when you get married and you're focused on the wedding, you're not really looking at what's life going to be like. That's right. You know, you're trying to get through that one day, or you're getting to that one day. Yeah.
Getting to that one day.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you find out you're pregnant, you're going through, your surgeon says abort. Yeah. Had you had chemo and stuff? Had you had those kind of treatments?
I did not do chemo. I did not do radiation.
Okay. Well, that's good.
No, which is why I was able to get pregnant, because chemo, I mean, I didn't do chemo because I wanted to have a child, and I was 37, 36, 37 when I had cancer. So the chances of going into early menopause are about as high as not having a remission if you do chemo. So I was like, no, we're not. If I still want to have children, I can't do chemo. So I took that off the table. And then I went to see an alternative doctor, and he was like, no, you're not doing either one. Because if the cancer comes back, radiation is your first defense. So we very, very strategically, and then I did.
How did you find the cancer in the first place? A lump?
During a monthly breast exam. Yeah. Yeah.
Your doctor happened to find it?
No, I found it. I found it. Yeah. 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 I'm 36 years old. I literally was like somebody had put half of a walnut in my breast.
So you knew I got to have this looked at.
Well, so
that like maybe.
No. There was no maybe about it.
Oh, wow.
It was like, holy smokes. We're going to the doctor.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a good thing you did that. Okay. Yeah.
And then I failed every test. I failed, you know, it's like, oh, it, you know, at your age, nothing. And then every test they did, they were like, yeah, we need to do every test they did another one. It was awful. But they kept saying the chances are really slim because of your age and blah, blah, blah.
What they think the walnut was.
I don't know. They were like, statistically, it's really unlikely that this is cancer. So yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
As if that matters when you have it, right? Yeah. The statistics don't matter.
Right.
I took statistics. It's either one or zero. And it was one, you know? It's like, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
After the fact, it was either one or zero, and it was
that's
one.
Right. It's one or the other. It's yay or nay.
Yeah. All right. So there you are. You're okay. The natural doctor says you're okay, right? To have the baby.
The natural doctor was fine with me. He was actually totally on board with me having a child. And the surgeon was like, no, 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 you need to abort. Because if, and the reasoning being that if the cancer came back, they couldn't do anything to treat it. They want to get you through 5 years, which would have put me at, I don't know, 42, 43 before I could have, conceived. Not, and it was not an issue.
So they had removed it though. They had removed it and it obviously hadn't spread. So.
Right. And then they went back and did more surgery. I went to a cancer center and we did more surgery to check for lymph node involvement and all of that. And you know, the, there's the new surgery that they do for breast cancer is they do a small incision and they test just one lymph node.
Oh.
It's called the sentinel lymph node. I was part of that study. I was like number 398 out of 400 and was part of that study. And I had surgery in April and by August they were doing the new surgery. So that was pretty cool. Yeah.
And you didn't, it hadn't spread, obviously.
And I had, it had no spread. And so the theory was that if the sentinel lymph node, which is sort of like the managing lymph node, who then that lymph node then parses everything out to everybody else. If that went negative, 99.9% of the time, everything else is negative. So now they only take one lymph node where they used to take like 29 or whatever from under your arm. Yeah. So.
And that would affect people's immunity and all that stuff badly, right? Yeah.
So I had done alternative therapies that were immune system boosting, which was positive. I felt great. So all of those things, I felt healthier than I had felt in most of my life. Because I had learned things about food and diet that were making a big difference in my life. And anyway, so it was a great time to get pregnant in a way, I think.
Right. Cause you were so healthy. Yeah.
Right. That's right. So anyway.
Okay. All right. So then.
So the surgeon says you need to abort. And I was like, no, I'm having this child. This is a gift from God. The chances were pretty amazing that I was even pregnant considering the two of us and the efforts we were making to not get pregnant. So I just carried on and the relationship ended up sort of ending. I was, you know, it just was really hard. We remained friends, but the relationship side of the relationship ended. And my father was really struggled with it. My father was very conservative and he believed that you should be married before you have a child. And he strongly felt that I should give the baby up for adoption. So I had sort of no support from boyfriend, no support from my father and the surgeon saying you need to abort. And I was like, no.
And was your mother?
My mother wasn't alive. So she died when I was alive. So she was long gone. So,
So you did what every girl would do.
That's right. I was 37. I was financially, and it wasn't like, do you know what I mean? It wasn't going to be a huge struggle. It was definitely a life change, but it wasn't a huge struggle. Best thing I've ever done. Best ride of my life, you know? So I named the baby Will because it was his will that he was here. buckled my seatbelt and went for the ride of my life, right? Raising a child. And Annie was still alive. Annie was my best ally of all of anybody. I mean, she was like that. Her thing when I told her that I was pregnant, number one, she already knew because she always knew that stuff. And she said, "This is God's child. Ain't nobody's business but you and God."
Wow.
She was so great.
And how old was she by then? She must have been
like 84 at that point.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so you were still in Louisville.
I was still in Louisville. And so we would go, I would take Will with me to go see her and she would put him on her lap. And I mean, it was the sweetest thing ever. She just loved that child. And in January of 2001, she passed and she was headed there. It wasn't a huge surprise, but she wasn't doing so poorly that we were expecting it per se. Anyway, so she passed, and that was when my father still hadn't come on board. Will's father still hadn't really come on board. And I was like, you know what? I don't need to live here anymore. I don't need to be here and raise him in this. And so that was when we made the decision to move and just start all over. And we had just met in September the year before. We met an alpaca at the Kentucky State Fair. And I just absolutely fell in love with this animal and was like, you know what? That's what I want to do. I want to raise alpacas. And so we just, it was like Annie died in January. In April, we came here for the first time to look for property. And it was like, if this is the right thing to do, I mean, it was not this easy, but it was like, if this is the right thing for me to do, I will find a piece of property I can't say no to. And so we came, and of course, part of me was kicking and screaming the whole way. You're crazy. What are you doing? Leaving every bit of support that you have. You don't know anybody here. Like, what are you like? Are you nuts? And, but anyway, we found this piece of property that we're on now, and the rest is history. Like, it was just.
So what month did you find it?
And we found it at the end of, it was actually March we came. It was the end of March of 2001. And, we left here. We saw, that was the first time I looked at it. We came back and looked again, had a second showing. I insisted that I bring Will and our golden retriever, Grace. So the three of us came back and looked at it again, and everybody was on board, and we started negotiating as we left town. And I mean, here we are 20, whatever years later.
So you went in March, and how fast did you, like, you saw it, you knew that was the one.
Saw it, and I wasn't sure. It was bigger than I wanted. It was more money than I wanted to spend. You know, there were all those things.
Yeah.
And yet it was the one that I kept going back to. And the real estate agent said to me at one point, if you had to make a choice now, what would it be? And I was like, the one with the apple orchard. And she goes, but I thought you said that was too much money. And I was like, I did. But you're asking me if I thought what I thought I would do. It would be the one with the apple orchard. And so that was where it just, you know, I don't know when the last time was you look for a house, but there's, for me, there's this whole thing that I look at something, I imagine myself in it. I imagine moving my furniture in. There's that whole process that goes on.
Yeah.
You exhausting. Know, it's exhausting. It's like moving 10 times, you know, it's like, well, this would fit here. I have to get rid of that bed and da da da. And this would be where the bathroom is and all of those things. And this was the one that really fit for me. So.
Wow. All right. So we're going to go to our commercial break now that you've finally bought the farm, as they say, and then we'll come back and hear what you've done with it. It's incredible. I want everyone to know what you're doing over there. So, okay. Thank you. We'll be right back with a word from our sponsor.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Welcome back to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And as always, thank you to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you want to bring experiential social emotional learning to your schools or businesses, go to KikoriApp.com and schedule a time to talk to them. It will change your lives. It will bring back connection and belonging to your kids and to your teams. And if you find areas where you don't feel like you can speak up and you don't feel free and you feel a little stuck, email me at Hillary@gettingrealwithhillary.com and let's have a conversation and get you free. Now, I am thrilled to bring back Jane Lee Rankin so you can hear what she did with the farm. Here she is. Because she was telling me before and I'm just like, wow, this is so cool. Okay, so. Tell us about that. You get to the farm. How old was Will? How old was he?
Will was two by the time we got here. So we were here the 1st of October of that same year.
Okay.
And he was two, very gregarious kid. Just really very social, very gregarious. We used to stop when we would travel, we would stop at Cracker Barrel and he would walk around the restaurant and invite people to sit with us.
That's great.
So he was he was a very outgoing, gregarious kid. So it made it easy. And living in a small town made lots of sense. Like I didn't have to worry about him wandering to tables when we went out to dinner kind of thing, because he was very hard to contain. And being on land made a lot of sense for him. I mean, he spent his days playing in the mud and we created this little building area for him and it had, you know, sort of a sand floor and lots of building stuff. And it was his area for the longest time. And he could, you know, mess it up. And he had his old trucks out there, all those
boy stuff. Yeah.
Boy stuff. Yeah. All the good stuff.
So. Now, and then what did you do? So when you got there, like, what did you do? Did you know, I know you said you had fallen in love with the alpaca. Did you know you were going to raise them at that point?
I did. Okay. Now, interestingly enough, in going back and writing this book, I hadn't done anything about the fact that I knew that that's what I wanted to do, except buy a piece of property that I thought I could raise them on. And the property had a barn, not any fencing. It had an old growth apple orchard that had been abandoned and an abandoned Christmas tree farm. So the first thing we did was we took out the old Christmas trees. We joked that we were going to do a Dr. Seuss Christmas tree patch and sell the trees with a Dr. Seuss hat, a red and white striped hat, because they were all sort of curvy and gnarly and, you know, they look like Dr. Seuss trees. And that was the first thing we did was pull out those trees. And that took quite a while. The first animal we got was chickens. And I had done some research and I wanted Dominicker chickens. And there happened to be an avian bird flu scare. So you couldn't ship chickens anywhere in the country. Ugh. So we researched anybody in the area that had them. And there was somebody in Columbus, Ohio, or near Cincinnati, Ohio. So when we were back in Louisville one time, we drove up and picked up these chickens and then drove back to North Carolina with chickens in the back of I was like five hens and a rooster. And that was how we started with our chickens. I mean, it was just, but what a great way to raise a kid, right? Like,
So you sold eggs? Like, what were you doing for work? You didn't have to.
Only for our own people.
Okay.
So that we could go out and feed the chickens and gather eggs and, right? Great way to live, right?
Yeah.
And that was the first thing we brought on the property. And then we built a barn.
Okay.
And then after the barn was built, I decided that it was time for me to go do some research about alpacas. And I kept hearing about a lady named Terry who had a farm really near here and she was raising alpacas. And so I heard in all horror, I heard that she was getting ready to move. And I was like, oh no. So I was like very quickly got in touch with her and started going to her farm and sort of training with her with alpacas. And she was indeed getting ready to move like in months. So there wasn't a lot of time. And that was in 2003.
Was she taking the alpacas with her?
She was taking some of the alpacas with her, but she was also selling. She sold alpacas. She had like 70 at her farm. So she had quite a few.
Oh.
So we ended up buying alpacas from her and moving them here. We had alpacas on the property by December of 2003.
Wow.
For Christmas. And it was loads of fun. We, you know, but I had not done all those things that you think, oh, you're going to have this idea and then you're going to do all this research. Not the way that I seem to do things.
That's all right. So,
it seems to be working for me. So whatever. Anyway, so.
Where'd you put them in the barn? Did they go in the barn?
We put them in the barn and then we would walk them out to the field, which was not attached to the barn, which is what most alpaca owners do. They have, you know, a shelter in the field that they can come and go from. So we had to do some revamping after that, but it was fine. We started out, that's the way we started out. And then we built another barn that they went in a field and that kind of thing. But we started with two girls, we started with Celeste and Frosty were the two girls that we started with. And Millie, who was this little 4-month-old alpaca who was bottle fed. So we were bottle feeding twice a day with this little alpaca. She was adorable. We could put her in the back of the Subaru. We could drive her to town with us. She went to the bank. She was like, she went, not all the time, but we could take her to the bank. We took her to shows. And then our idea was the alpaca industry is very family friendly. And if you are breeding and selling at that point in 2003, if you were breeding and selling alpacas, you were taking them to shows and you were getting ribbons and you were meeting people who had studs that were higher quality, breeding to those to raise the quality of your animals. There was this whole thing, but Will could go with me. Will could show alpacas and they did costume contests and there were kids running around and everybody knew who everybody was and it was totally safe. And so that's where we were headed. We were going to breed, we were going to sell, and we were going to have Kriyas, which are the baby alpacas, and sell those. And that was our business plan. That's what we were going to do. This really quiet, whatever, alpaca lifestyle. Well,
alpaca lifestyle, yeah.
in spring of 2004, we added a male alpaca named Mojo. And his name was MJ. We changed it to Mojo because he was just too cute to be just two initials. And so we changed his name to Mojo so that we had one to travel if we were taking one of the girls. And at that point, we had four girls because Celeste had had her baby, had her Kriya right after we bought her. So we had four girls and a boy. So we had five alpacas. You know, we were like moving up in the world, five alpacas. And we had bought a trailer. We bought a little 4x8 trailer that we put windows in and we could pull it behind our truck. We had a truck, we had a tractor, like, you know, all the things, right?
You had all the toys. Yeah.
We were slowly moving up in the world. It was a great fun time. Anyway, so
now, can I ask a question that people might be wondering? Because I'm wondering, like, were you just living off of your money before, or did any of this make money for you?
None of it was, because we had just invested in moms and babes, right? So we had increased the value of our alpacas because we'd had a baby, but not really because we hadn't really gotten going. And I still had real estate in Louisville that I owned.
Okay.
So there was, you know, and
to buy all the stuff.
The cookbook was still selling. We had done second edition in 2003. So, you know, there was definitely some stuff going on. There wasn't,
You were okay. I'm thinking, cha-ching, cha-ching, what are you doing? Yeah, but okay. Good. Right. I just needed to calm myself down. Okay, good.
Okay, you calm down. And in the industry, at that time, alpacas were really expensive. So it was an investment to start with alpacas.
Okay.
But we had started with good quality. We'd started with females. They were bred, you know, all of those things that you do. And you buy insurance. When you buy them, you buy insurance. You bought insurance on the animal. So if anything happened, they were covered, right?
Okay.
Anyway, so in March or May of that year, we sheared the alpacas, except for Millie, who was getting ready to go to a show with us. And sometimes you showed them with their fiber 100% on, or you showed them newly sheared. But often in the spring, they wanted them full fleece. So she was full fleece. Everybody else had been sheared. And I took Will to, he was at a mother's, it was actually a preschool. So I took him to this little preschool he was going to. I went and had a meeting with the lawyer. We were setting up, you know, the LLCs for the business and all of those things that you have to do. Yeah. And I came back and there was an alpaca by the road laying down and had been hurt.
One of yours?
The fencing was everywhere. And we had had a mountain lion attack. So we had,
oh my God.
When I got home, broad daylight, one alpaca was already dead. And we had little wild card, little baby was already dead. Celeste was almost dead. Mojo and Frosty were in the barn and they were still alive, but injured. And I couldn't find Millie. And I finally found Millie near the wood line. Anyway, it was a mountain lion attack. The only animals that survived the day were Frosty and Mojo. And So because I had a trailer, you know, I called the vets came, we took them to the University of Tennessee, which is 3 hours away from here, where they could be in a hospital, an animal hospital, and could be tended to. Frosty ended up dying there later. Yeah. So Mojo was the only one that survived of all of them.
Oh, he was the only one. Man.
I mean, so it was devastating, absolutely devastating. So we, you know, we had insurance money. I mean, it was devastating and it was terrifying because Will was, you know, 3 feet tall and it was a mountain lion. And the only thing the people agreed was that whatever it was coming back. So yeah, welcome to life in the mountains. Yeah. So we started over. We had Mojo. We got a buddy for him before the last one died. We started over again. We had insurance money to start over again, which I could have cared less about, mm-hmm. except that it was helpful, right?
Yeah.
So we started buying new alpacas. We refenced. We found out how to protect them. And we worked with people out west who had mountain lions and figured out how they did it. They did donkeys in a sort of a field, a moat around the alpacas. And then llamas in the field with the alpacas or livestock guardian dogs, one or the other. And then, you know, so that's what we started to do. And we restarted the farm, wow. Literally, because we had, everybody went away and then, you know, we rebought and they boarded somewhere until we got it safe and we knew we were safe. And we started over again. And in one of the things that we added was up the hill, unsecured by any sort of guardian animal, we put meat goats because everybody agreed whatever it was going to come back for food. And I figured, you know, if you're going to come back and you want food, I'm going to give you a $50 animal, not thousands of dollar animal. Yeah. Right.
Wow.
So we restarted, but we put llamas on the inside. We put donkeys on the outside. We put goats up the hill. And we restarted. We bought new alpacas and we restarted. It was terrifying. And it was like, you know, it just didn't seem like the thing to do to bail on it.
Right.
And we became a story.
Mm.
And story sells. And people heard the story in town, would drive all the way up the driveway to see the farm that had the mountain lion attack with the llamas and the donkeys and the goats. And that's how we became like an agritourism farm where people were actually coming.
Wow.
Totally changed where we were headed.
Wow. And did the mountain goat ever come back?
Mountain lion never came back. Wow. We've had him on the property, but we've never had another. Yeah. Never had a problem.
So, okay. So people were coming. And then when did you start giving them tours and stuff? Like,
right, so we started about 2006. We said, you know, every time somebody comes up, it's 45 minutes. And we're kind of the end of the road, the top of the hill, the end of the road. So if you get here, you're here, right? So it's not like you're just driving by.
Yeah.
It's one of those driveways. When you get here, you're either supposed to be here, or you've gone the wrong way. Mm-hmm. So it would take a while to get everybody, you know, to talk to them and answer questions and whatever. And then they would move on. So we were like, let's find a time. So let's do a tour on Saturdays at 2 and have people come visit and take a tour. So that was in 2006. Where are we now? We're in 2024. I mean, 2006. Yeah, 2006. So
that's almost 18 years. Yeah.
So for a long time, we've had people coming. We've really developed that business. We followed what people are interested in. We added a store. We sell yarn, alpaca yarn. We actually added Angora goats, which produce mohair, the fiber mohair, like the old mohair coats. And we shear those twice a year for their fiber. We have yarn from them. And then we have all sorts of products. We have bees. So we have honey. Mm. We have eggs from our chickens. We have more than 5 chickens and we have eggs from our chickens. So we've just added and added and added and followed the market. And we now have, last year we had over 11,000 people come to the farm for tours. So it's turned into a huge business.
And you have employees that do all of this, right?
Yep. Wow. Yep. So not at all what my goal. It's turned into something completely different.
But you love it.
And I love it. Yeah. And I love it. And I teach agritourism. So I'm involved in teaching that to other farms. I consult with other farms that want to add that to their farm. It's this whole thing.
Oh my God.
It's so important because people are hungry for connection to the land, for connection to animals, for getting back in touch. We're so overconnected in one way and underconnected in another. Mm-hmm. And so we provide that for people. So we're providing experiences for people and families, and they come and have a great time together, do something they've never done, learn something they've never learned, and spend an hour. And I know that it changes their lives.
Wow. That's so cool. And it just, you know what? It's like you just followed the path, and here you're doing what you love, and it's like what everybody wants. So congratulations. Wow. So now you wrote a book, and it's called
Farm Family.
Farm Family, and it's on Amazon, and that's your story. That's this story.
And it's a story. Yes.
Of your farm. So people.
Yeah, okay. And raising Will and, you know, what it was like to raise a son while starting a farm. And of course, he was part of all of it. Mm. Integral part of all of it.
Thank God you guys weren't on the farm that day. That's what I keep thinking when you had the mountain lion.
Right. Right.
So, yeah. But it really took you in this direction. So, okay, we're not going to go there. Yeah. Okay. So we have like 3 minutes left. I want you to tell them what you told me about your vision and how they find you. And we'll have it in the notes. So we'll have all the links so you can book a tour or buy the book or whatever. But I loved what you said. I know you just said it about, you know, bringing people, connecting to nature, to groups, to each other, and to the animals.
Yeah.
But you also said about uplifting the world. So what would you like to say to people about your, you know, like who you are for the world and what you're doing for the world? Because I love that.
So as I spend time with friends that are out living their lives in the city or involved in whatever people are involved in, and not that I'm not involved with that, but whatever they're involved with, they're always like, and there you are up on top of the mountain. I'm like, yep, holding down the high note because somebody's got to hold it. And I do. I feel like that, you know, there's always a balance to everything, right? And somebody has to be the balance. And it seems like so many people are concerned about where the world is going. I'm concerned as well. But there's that balance. And here at our farm, we have a working organism, right? So The dogs are taking care of the goats. The llamas and the donkeys are taking care of the alpacas. The people are taking care of the animals. People are coming to see the farm, which helps feed the animals and keeps the farm going. It's this very organic movement of energies that work together. And it is really a high note of the world. We are up here holding the high note. People come, they get back in touch with what it's like to be on a farm. So many people don't have an experience of a farm in any way, shape, or form. I think it's 2% of the world, or 2% of the United States has an experience of a farm. So 98% of the country doesn't know what it's like to be on a farm. And that is so crucial to who we are. It's where our food comes from. It's where our fiber comes from. It's what feeds us and sustains us. And it makes sense when you come to a farm to understand how things work, you know, how the land works and how vegetables work and how plants work and rain and, you know, even the manure that we have helps feed the plants, that the manure that the chickens make help feed our garden. And we actually sell the manure from the alpacas for people to use. It's a very organic, natural kind of thing. And the fiber, because everything we all wear is made of some sort of fiber. It could be made from plastic, still all made the same way that we used to make cotton. It's either woven or it's knit, maybe done by machine, but it's all done the same way. It's very basic. Mm. And that is what I think we're missing and are very hungry for in the world today.
Thank you. And the other thing you said was uplifting the world.
Yeah. And we're uplifting the world. I mean, we're uplifting the people who come to see us. We're uplifting people and through Facebook with our posts about our animals. We're uplifting. I mean, this conversation has been uplifting, right?
Yes.
So, and the book is a way, it's a memoir. So it was a very personal journey for me to write it. And it's a very personal journey. The story is a very personal journey, but it's a way of taking what we've got happening here at the farm off the farm. And one of my goals in writing it was I want you as the reader to feel the cold of the floor of the barn on a winter day when I'm holding an animal and willing it to live or helping it to live. I want you to have that experience because not everybody has that experience.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. This has been so much fun. I can't wait to come visit you at the farm and see all the animals and see what
you're doing. It's been an honor to be on. Thank you so much. Thank you for the work that you do because you're uplifting the world as well.
Thank you. We're all elevating the conversation of the planet together. So thank
you. That's right.
Yes. All right. Bye, everyone. See you next week.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.